On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
I can do it. You can help me. We can make it work. Make it work. Make it work. Let's make it work. Let's make it.
Christy Moore and Paul Doran there performing 35 years ago this week. If anyone who's around who's listening this afternoon remembers that, 35 years ago, it'll make you feel very old, and I'm sorry about that. It was a time when nearly a quarter of a million of us were unemployed, but in slightly different circumstances than we're facing right now. It was a time where emigration was at some of the highest levels since the birth of the state, and some of Ireland's biggest names felt that it was time for action, and so they organised something called Self-Aid. In many ways, a copy of Live Aid, which had happened the previous summer, a 14-hour telethon concert which brought together Christy Moore, Elvis Costello, The Pogues, Clannad, and U2 as headliners, all in the name of trying to get people some work. But it wasn't all plain sailing, and the gig had many detractors, even leading to one act pulling out at the 11th hour. And Donal Fallon has been scouring the archives to tell us all about it. Donal, good afternoon. Good to see you again. 1986 was a year that began badly and then arguably just kept getting worse.
Yeah, 1986. The facts of 1986 speak for themselves. 71,260 people under 25 were unemployed, which is just staggering. And across the workforce as a whole, just under a quarter of a million people were out of work. So there's no great nostalgia for 1986 in Dublin or in Ireland more broadly. And you know, well, there were all kinds
I hope my parents think of it more fondly, but that might be more personal circumstances. But we'll park that for a minute. Sorry, go on.
There were a whole host of things in 1986 that people remember with no affection whatsoever. The very divisive divorce referendum, the seemingly out of control levels of emigration. It was a year that began with the loss of Phil Lynott, tragically young Phil Lynott when he died. I think Phil's death really said much about the worsening struggles with kind of, you know, addiction in our cities. Heroin was out of control in Dublin. And there seemed to be very little to be enthusiastic about in a time that was pretty grey. And then comes Self-Aid. The song, which we heard, is totally forgettable, but the gig is anything but. And the names you rattled off there, you know, Elvis Costello, The Pogues, Clannad, you could add another list, Rory Gallagher, The Chieftains, Van Morrison, you know, everyone who was anyone played this gig on the 17th of May, 1986. Tens of thousands of us went to the RDS, about 30,000. Hundreds of thousands watched it from home. And weirdly, it's a curiously kind of unremembered event. I didn't see one piece in the press last week on its 35th anniversary. A few scattered recollections on Twitter. The reason we're doing this slot, actually, is I saw a tweet by someone who was there. And looking back on it, I think what we find is a surprisingly divisive event at the time. But an event which in many ways was enormously culturally significant. The final gig of the Boomtown Rats, at least for 27 years. The first appearance of Tin Lizzy since the death of Phil. And a U2 set that many people who were there consider to be their finest moment.
It's anyone you talk about the emigration, and because I was, you know, spoiler alert, I was born in that year. So, you know, everyone remembers the reading in the years from the year of their own birth quite well. 1986 is the one that ends with Mary Black singing As I Leave Behind Nadine and everyone getting on the super bus and going to London, even though they've got no connections over there, but they're just would be happier to chance their arms. And it's, yeah, it definitely comes across as a grim time. In some ways, Self-Aid was working off the tried and tested formula that had been set the previous summer by Live Aid.
Absolutely. And I mean, we can forget just how successful Live Aid was. We think about Live Aid as a gig that happens in London. There's 72,000 people in London. There's just under 90,000 people in Philadelphia. I mean, this is a global gig on a scale that had never been done before. And Bob Geldof made it happen, you know, an Irishman at the helm of it. He pitched the idea to Harvey Goldsmith. And yeah, look, there were some minor technical difficulties in the broadcast, but on the whole, it was a tremendous success. Nothing like it had been done. And, you know, Bob talking about it in his book said, we took an issue that was nowhere on the political agenda and through the language of the planet, which is not English, but rock and roll, we were able to address the intellectual...
Bob Geldof line.
Very Bob Geldof, isn't it? The intellectual absurdity and the moral repulsion of people dying of want in a world of surplus. Now, Live Aid was something that you could replicate on a smaller scale anywhere. So you had Farm Aid, which was pitched by Bob Dylan. And people like Willie Nelson, Neil Young played that one, raising money for American farmers. I think Farm Aid actually still goes on. Sport Aid is much more forgotten.
I'd never heard of Sport Aid until you sent in your notes this morning and I had to go and look it up. There's probably a reason why it was just so forgettable, because just nothing happened.
Like, absolutely. Yeah. But the idea of putting on a telethon, getting whatever talent you could and raising money for a good cause, Live Aid proved that it could be good.
And then this drags a question to the whole global setting, and you look at the likes of Bob Geldof and you look at U2, who had such a memorable set at Live Aid, and you say, these are all these Irish people doing such great work on the global stage, and everyone remembers that stat about Ireland being the highest donors per head of population for Band Aid and for Live Aid. And then people say, well, why aren't you guys doing something closer to home?
Yeah, the Irish naysayers always come out of the woodwork very, very early on. And the whataboutery after Live Aid was enormous in this country. And I mean, people were quick to highlight the involvement of U2 and Geldof. And, you know, what about the issue at home? What are you doing for unemployment in Ireland? So self-aid is the brainchild of several people. Geldof is there again. But Irish television staff, television production people, they really like this idea of doing this on RTE. Tony Boland, Neil Matthews, they're eager to kind of utilise the reach of the station. And a lot of RTE people had actually gone to London and kind of volunteered and worked on Live Aid, which was an incredible experience, like a transformative experience to be involved in something so global, so massive. So there's a real desire among RTE production to do this. And they think it could be a moment not only in the history of Irish music, but in the history of Irish broadcasting. Mm. And they pull in everyone. They bring in the Irish Congress of Trade Unions and they decide that what they're going to do, civil society, RTE, the music industry, they're going to do something and they're going to call it Jobs Aid.
And that's where the story gets interesting, because we just introduced it as self-aid. And I'd imagine the idea of then transferring responsibility to those who themselves are jobless proved a bit contentious.
Absolutely. You've nailed it. And this is the beginning of the tension. So when you change the name from Jobs Aid to self-aid, there's kind of mumblings of discontent. The Congress of Trade Unions in particular kick off. And they feel that the focus of the event, you know, is wrong. And Harry Brown, the journalist and a biographer of Bono, not a very friendly biography of Bono, but a biography of Bono nonetheless, he makes the point that there was a groundswell of opinion in some circles that self-aid, with its emphasis on positivity and the pull-up-by-our-bootstraps way of thinking, could take pressure off the government on the issue of jobs.
This notion that you could just wish your way out of insecurity without needing the government or someone else to come along and help you do it. You can kind of understand why there was tensions there. Given everything that was going on, and given that Band Aid probably had, and Live Aid that followed, obviously, given that it kind of set a template which no doubt was being followed all across the world, you can sort of ask, how did they manage to land a lineup that had the Boomtown Rats and Thin Lizzy and Bono and Clannad and Rory Gallagher and Elvis Costello and everyone else? Because that's some lineup to get for an Irish gig.
It was incredible. I mean, Harvey Goldsmith was the key to making Live Aid happen. You know, he basically was the key mogul figure, if you will, in the music industry globally at that time. And he just made the connections with the managers of all these acts. Ireland being a much smaller place, this was a little bit easier. And it was Jim Aiken, enormous figure in the history of Irish music and gigs. Aiken Promotions still going strong in modern times, and hopefully they'll rebound very strong from the current pandemic. Mm. But he held the key to self-aid. Very respected figure. I mean, he gets a 28-act bill together, and it remains the largest ever put on a major stage in Ireland. Some of the acts he had a long history of working with: Christy Moore, Moving Hearts, the Dannon, Clannad, and then enormous acts like U2. They're at the height of their global reach. And I think what was very touching was the issue of unemployment is obviously very much linked to migration. You know, so many Irish people, as you said, in that reeling in the ears after London, after Liverpool, after Manchester. So Elvis Costello and the Pogues are on the bill. So it brings a nice diaspora touch, if you will, to the RDS.
You mentioned that there were some very vocal critics in the press. Eamon McCann, probably the loudest of them.
Oh, of course. Yeah, of course. And Colm O'Callaghan, a fantastic blog, the Blackpool Sentinel, he writes a lot about alternative music in Ireland in the 80s and the 90s. He's kind of covered the controversies around this better than anyone. Eamon McCann was the most visible kind of public opponent. And he turned the slogan of the day, which was self-aid, make it work. It became self-aid makes it worse, the critics of the event. The great Derry humour of McCann.
But that McCann reminds me of, this is a terrible tangent now, but I know that there is one flagship Tesco outlet within the Dublin commuter area. I won't say which one. And behind every till where they've got the sign up that says every little helps, someone has scraped off the first and last letters so that in every instance it just says very little help, which I like just as an element of wit, if nothing else. Sorry, do go ahead.
McCann was there at the press conference. He put all his views of the event to Aiken, you know, two great kind of Northern characters, and they kind of trashed it out. But, you know, some of the language around the concert is kind of surprising to us now. In Dublin magazine, they went as far as to run a really unflattering image of Bono on the cover. And the headline was, Rock Against the People, the Great Self-Aid Farce, which is extraordinary.
That's right, because in Dublin wasn't really much, like it didn't have editorial really stuff that time. It was more of a kind of a listings magazine.
Like an events listing magazine, but it kind of bursts onto the public consciousness with this. And then in defending the event and its approach, you know, Tony Boland and other people have to come out publicly. And Tony says, I can respect the fact that other people have objected on ideological grounds, but we live in a capitalist system and we have to talk about jobs this side of the revolution, not after it.
That's a great line.
And then Christy Moore comes out, and who could criticise the politics of Christy? You know, Christy was always solid on these issues. But Christy came out and said, if nothing else, the show might lift people's spirits for a day. Which, and that was a good enough reason.
Something that changed for a lot of people probably haven't watched Eurovision last night, because I think it just gave everyone a lift for those who spent the 4 hours watching it.
Absolutely. And Christy just defended it on that basis, whatever valid criticisms there were. Paul Cleary from Dublin band The Blades, great band, the band U2 could have been, The Blades. He pulled out at the 11th hour. And, you know, in the great Irish tradition of splits, the first item on the agenda is always the split. There was a number of kind of smaller gigs, kind of protest gigs against self-aid on the day across the city.
You mentioned that there were some sort of symbolic musical moments on the gig, and there were perhaps some of the most iconic moments in Irish musical history that were part of this bill, from reunions to breakups.
Yeah, there's two great moments. The Boomtown Rats, I mean, the Rats were kind of born in the late 70s at that time of punk, and they kind of outlasted punk. You know, they stuck around a bit longer, kind of moved to a poppier sound, but they were kind of running out of steam, and they played this thundering set. And when it's over, Geldof says, "It's been a very good 10 years. Rest in peace." Oh. And to the credit of the Boomtown Rats, you know, often bands say we're done now and they're back a year later.
And then hell freezes over and they do a reunion tour. Yeah,
they went away for 27 years. So for the guts of three decades, there was no Boomtown Rats gigs to go to. And then there's this really emotional moment where Tin Lizzy performs so soon after the death of Phil. Gary Moore's on lead vocals, Don't Believe a Word, Geldof for the Cowboy song, and then everybody, like literally everybody, for Whiskey in the Jar.
As tends to be the case for these sorts of things, no matter who else is on the bill, you two end up stealing the show.
They were furious, they were full of energy, they were kind of firing off in all directions, and there's a great addition into the lyrics of Bad, which capture the anger Bono felt, I think, at In Dublin Magazine. They crawled out of the woodwork onto the pages of cheap Dublin magazines. But I think it's the most experimental U2 set that's ever been performed live. Eddie Cochran's Come On Everybody, great cover of that. Yeah. John Lennon's Cold Turkey and Maggie's Farm.
Of which we have a little excerpt to play in honour of Bob Dylan having his birthday this coming week. Let's play a little bit of that. U2 performing Maggie's Farm.
Well, I wake up in the morning, walk out into the rain, got a handful of ideas that driving me insane. It's a shame, but I'd even scrub the floor. Well, I ain't gonna work on Maggie's Farm no more.
Maggie's Farm being performed by U2 at Self Aid. What I'd like, actually, just in passing, that you mentioned one of the covers that they did was Eddie Cochran's Come On Everybody. This would have probably been the time before the first People in Need telethon, and it might well have inspired that, and then you suddenly see the lineage where all these things follow through, and you can probably understand the lineage and how influential this was when you go and look at how many people actually tuned in on the day.
Extraordinary numbers of people tuned in to watch this. I mean, there was nothing else to do really in Ireland in 1986, and it did capture the imagination of the public. They set up a telephone line. Potential employers could ring in and offer work.
We should have mentioned that was the purpose of it, that it wasn't just like, let's raise awareness of unemployment, because everyone was fully aware of what was going on. But the idea was, if you had some work that you could create for someone, call in and then we'll find someone to
An incredible idea. 2.4 million people tuned in. Now, to put that in context, population of Ireland at the time is about 3.5 million people in the state. So 2.4 million watched this gig. More Irish tellies tuned in to Self-Aid than had actually watched Live Aid.
Wow.
And Colm's blog makes a point that 90% of all homes watching television on the day watched Self-Aid for an average of 3 hours each, which is incredible. And look, let's be honest, Self-Aid did not fix all the problems of 1980s Ireland. Some of the criticisms of the event were probably fair, but it was a day of kind of great excitement in a city and country that badly needed them. You know, for a lot of young people, it was a great day out. And I think it gave people, this is a really important point about Self-Aid, it gave people a sense of their own value and a belief that there should be jobs for them at home. And look, it's testament to Geldof, to Aiken, to everyone else who worked on it. That lineup is still so strong today, 35 years later. It's a dream lineup that would bring, I think, 30,000 of us anywhere. In a heartbeat.
I hope it's not too long before 30,000 of us are going anywhere for a common event, and today's stories about the All-Ireland Finals maybe having that sort of crowd. It's the sort of thing that'll get everybody amused. It's a fascinating little element of Irish life, and often overlooked because of some of the other big public action gigs that existed, but nonetheless a very seminal moment for Irish broadcasting and musical history, as you say. Donald Fallon, thank you very much. Donald Fallon, while you're here, by the way, you might as well plug the new book, because I'm sick of talking about you being the author of the Come Here To Me book. You might as well tell us about your new one.
I'm very, very proud to work with 14 Henrietta Street, the museum that tells the story of 20th century Dublin, Tenement Dublin. And they've produced three books exploring the history of that house. So mine is called 14 Henrietta Street, From Tenement to Suburbia. And it tells the story of the residents of that house and, you know, moving out to the new Dublin suburbs.
Available in all good bookshops and probably some terrible ones as well. Donald Fallon, the author of that book, as well as the Come Here To Me books, and the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast on Dublin history, which you'll find online.